welcome to this throwback edition of the award-winning Best of the Left podcast, where we remember the past and choose to repeat it. Today's episode was originally published on November 10th, 2020, and I'm playing it today to give broader context to the history of American democracy, now that the 2024 election, with the two major party candidates firmly selected, gets into full swing. Sources today include Democracy Now!, Scene on Radio, The Laura Flanders Show, a TEDx talk, On the Media, Some More News, and The Majority Report.
We turn now to look at the case for abolishing the Electoral College. Two of the last three presidencies, Donald Trump's included, have gone to the candidate who lost the popular vote in 2000. The Supreme Court halted the Florida recount, handing the election to George W. Bush. It was later determined Vice President Al Gore actually won the election by 500,000 votes. In 2016, Hillary Clinton received almost 3 million more votes than Trump, but Trump still won. The Electoral College, enshrined in the U.S. Constitution by the wealthy white founders, many of whom were slaveholders, has allowed these victories where the loser wins. But a mass movement is building to elect the president through a national popular vote. For more on this effort, we're joined by journalist Jesse Wegman, member of the New York Times editorial board, author of Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. So, Jesse Wegman, welcome back to Democracy Now! Please explain the roots of the Electoral College and what this movement is all about.
Sure. Well, the framers who met at the Constitutional Convention really had no idea what they were doing when they established how to pick a president. They said themselves that it was the hardest issue they had to decide. They fought about it the entire summer of 1787. And at the very end, they basically threw together this jerry-rigged system that we now call the Electoral College in a side room of the convention hall, really just to get the thing done and get it sent out to the states for ratification. They didn't really care too much about how it operated because they knew George Washington was going to be the first president, so the stakes just didn't seem that high to them. But nevertheless, the system that they thought they were designing basically fell apart within the first 10 years. You know, the model we think we know is that there's this body of deliberate, thoughtful, educated, wise men who will make the choice for the people about who should lead the country. But within 10 years, it had completely stopped being like that with the rise of national political parties. It became a team sport, and that's what it remains today.
Talk about the role of slavery in the establishment of the Electoral College.
Sure. I mean, slavery is obviously at the heart of every compromise that is struck at that constitutional convention. The one we know that's most familiar to us is the Three-Fifths Compromise. And that was the deal by which the southern slaveholding states got to count three-fifths of their slaves toward their representation in Congress. So that equals roughly 12 to 14 extra representatives in Congress over the first decades of the country's life. And because of the way the Electoral College is designed, that translates into 12 to 14 extra electoral votes. The South actually won the White House, held on to the Speaker of the House, won many Supreme Court seats because of that extra power. It was called the slave power at the time, and it ran all the way up through the Civil War. And so that's really, slavery was clearly at the heart of the compromise, and it certainly, the Electoral College benefited the slave states well into the 19th century.
So you have long been a proponent of abolishing the Electoral College. Talk about how it is that, you know, losers win. For example, George W. Bush in 2000. And it is important to note that four of the people involved in that legal battle, now Amy Coney Barrett, John Roberts, Brett Kavanaugh, and the Supreme Court justice, who was justice at the time, Clarence Thomas, were all involved with this. Of course, Thomas ruling on behalf of Bush. But right. How it is now that the Electoral College gathers, talk about where that actually happens, and who right. the electors are, and what is right. the movement that is challenging this?
So electors are just average people like you and me. They are not deliberative wise men. They just happen to be people who know somebody who picks electors. Each candidate has their own slate of electors. Each state gets a number of electors equal to its representation in Congress. So it's members of the House plus its two senators. That's it. That's really most of what the Constitution says about the Electoral College. the thing that affects, that gives us popular vote losers as presidents, that's something that actually has nothing to do with the Constitution. It is state laws that are called winner-take-all laws. And these are laws that do exactly what they sound like, which is they take those electors and they award all of them to the winner of the state's popular vote. Whoever wins the state's popular vote wins all of that state's electors. So in California, 4.5 million people voted for Donald Trump in 2016. That's a lot of people. That's more than most states in the country. And yet they all were essentially invisible when it came time to cast the state's electoral votes, because California, like all but two states in the country, uses winner-take-all. That winner-take-all rule is why George W. Bush won in 2000. It's because even though Florida was essentially a tie by any measure, George W. Bush gets 25. That tie in the popular vote translates into 25 electoral votes for George W. Bush and zero for Al Gore. Same thing happened in 2016 in different states, in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. It was essentially tied, and yet Donald Trump won all the state's electoral votes. Hillary Clinton won none. This affects everyone and it harms everyone. Yes, it's hurt Democrats and helped Republicans twice in the last 20 years. So it seems like a partisan issue, but in fact, it's not. It harms everybody, no matter their political affiliation, all over the country. So that's why we get to this popular vote compact, which is the latest way that has been come up with to get us to a popular vote.
So explain the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact.
Right. So there's been 800 or so attempts throughout American history to amend or just abolish the college outright. They've all failed, with the exception of one, the 12th Amendment, which made some important adjustments to it. But obviously, an amendment is not the path we're going to take today. So about 15 years ago, a computer scientist in Northern California developed an idea where he realized that it was the winner-take-all law, those state laws that I just was talking about, that were the heart of the problem. So he said, well, states have total authority to decide how to award their electors. They don't have to do it by state winner-take-all. What if states representing a majority of electoral votes all gave their electors instead to the candidate who won the most votes everywhere in the country? And bingo, you have a national popular vote for president. So this is an interstate compact, which is basically just an agreement among states. There are many of them in existence right now all over the country for different issues. This is an agreement among states to award all of their electors, not to their statewide winner, but to the winner of the most votes in the whole country. And when states representing a majority, 270 electoral votes, which is what you need to win, join this agreement, it takes effect, and we elect the president by a popular vote without actually technically abolishing the Electoral College. It's actually using the Electoral College as the framers designed it. So 15 states right now have joined this agreement, plus DC, and together those states represent 196 electoral votes. You know, you got to get to 270, so subtract it, do the math, and you get 74 more electoral votes to go, and the agreement takes effect.
The radical Republicans temporarily in control, Congress put the former Confederate states under martial law in 1867. It required those states to hold constitutional conventions, with black people fairly represented and many former Confederate leaders banned from participation. Those new constitutions adopted the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery, and granted voting rights to black men. The Congress also created the Freedmen's Bureau, which built thousands of schools and hospitals and helped freed people negotiate fair labor contracts.
I mean, it's absolutely revolutionary.
Historian Kadada Williams of Wayne State University. She talks about the roughly 2,000 black men elected to office during Reconstruction at the local, state, and federal levels, most strikingly in places like South Carolina, where black people were the majority in the 1860s.
What you see for African Americans in South Carolina is when they are elected to state office, one of the biggest things they do is to make a move toward expanding democracy in their state. More people have access to government. More people have better representation by government. Government in places like South Carolina is doing more. It's doing things that today we take for granted. And African Americans are behind this push.
We'd like to see the upstairs gallery, is that possible?
Bobby Donaldson and I walk into the South Carolina State House, the domed Capitol building in Columbia. He's a professor of history here at the University of South Carolina. The state's constitutional convention in 1868, ordered and overseen by the federal government, produced a new state blueprint that gave all men the right to vote, regardless of race or property. The result, South Carolina's House of Representatives, seated in July 1868, looked like the state. It was majority black, 88 black members to 67 whites.
And across is the Senate.
Donaldson has led me to the House chamber.
You can think about between 1868 and 77, this space being occupied by African Americans, a cross-section, really. You had people who were natives of South Carolina who were holding elective office, and then you had some people who were transplants or carpetbaggers, or people who came here, some because of the Civil War and Union forces, some who came because of opportunities. And here is where they govern, and here is where they help to recreate the state of South Carolina.
The new state constitution mandated free public education for everyone for the first time, including poor white people who had had no access to schooling. And it required that every public institution be open to everyone. The University of South Carolina was integrated. Most white students left when black students were admitted in 1873, so for the next 4 years, the student body was 90% black. These dramatic changes were made by a majority black legislature in South Carolina, of all places. And those decisions were made in this building, the State House, that was a virtual shrine to white supremacy at the time, and in some ways still is. Remember, the Confederate battle flag flew on the State House grounds until it was finally removed in 2015. And inside the State House?
For example, there's a statue of John C. Calhoun.
Calhoun, one of the nation's leading pro-slavery politicians during the first half of the 19th century, and a vice president under Andrew Jackson. Calhoun called slavery a positive good, and he wrote this: "There never has yet existed a wealthy and civilized society in which one portion of the community did not, in point of fact, live on the labor of the other." So, Bobby Donaldson says, think of those African American lawmakers coming to work here in the 1860s and 70s.
These people are governing in a space where they know there is, there is this very clear assumption that this will be a failure. And if these people don't sort of fail on their own, we'll engineer it so that there's a failure.
The we who would engineer that failure was the state's white power structure. The white Southern backlash started right after the war and never let up. In 1865 and 66, most of the Southern state legislatures passed black codes. They banned black people from voting, denied them equal rights, and made them subject to vagrancy laws so they could be arrested practically at will. That was a major reason Congress saw the need to impose martial law and replace those white supremacist legislatures with Reconstruction governments. Military police suppressed the backlash somewhat, but never really stopped the violence by the newly founded Ku Klux Klan and similar groups, including direct political violence.
Democracy. You say at the very top that you weren't that interested to begin.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a word that really inspired me. So I spent my 20s in the aughts. So I was, 20 or 21 when 9/11 happened. And so I heard the word often uttered by George W. Bush saying he was going to bring democracy to Iraq and Afghanistan. We know that that didn't happen. And so the word had this really hollow, tragic quality. Right? It was not a word that inspired me. So words like liberation, equality, revolution, socialism, those were words where I would wake up. And I felt this disappointment. And yet intellectually, I know the word matters. And that was in the back of my mind for a long time. The fact that this was an important word I didn't relate to. But it was actually during 2011, the wave of movements calling for real democracy. So from the Arab Spring to the movement of the squares in Europe to Occupy Wall Street. And so people were gathered and chanting, you know, we want real democracy. This is what democracy looks like. That I thought, okay, it's time for me to interrogate this word and my ambivalence towards it and to figure out what democracy, you know, means to me.
All right. So hence the movie, What is Democracy? Here's the trailer. Take a look.
For me, this project began with the question, what is democracy? And I quickly realized it's not something that's ever actualized, but always something that is in motion, a kind of ideal we're reaching towards. But in practice, everywhere you look, democracy is in trouble. Progress can go into reverse, and terrible things have happened in the name of democracy.
Yes. It's being so abused and so misapplied, you know, compared to its original meaning, which means the power of the people, the government of the people. But so many have fought for the realization of a true democracy that in a way it's important not to abandon the word.
Right. And we also need to think hard about what that word even means.
Yes.
You see Silvia Federici there, the great historian of the commons, feminist, eco-feminist, and more. Talking about the people, did you come away thinking democracy is about the people and there is such a thing as the people? It's been pretty hard to get even women inserted into our notion of the people.
Yeah, it's really interesting, that question of the people. So what I thought was democracy's sort of hollow quality, right, this vagueness, now I see as this ambiguity that's actually really powerful. So I quite like the ancient definition of democracy, which is the demos, the people, rule or have power. So that's Kratos, right? And what I like about it is that this idea of what or who the people is can always be imagined, reimagined, reinvented. And then how we rule is also up for debate, contestation. So it's this concept that can evolve and change over time. You know, obviously it began in a very truncated form. If you look back at ancient Athens, for example, or look back at the founding of this country, the people did not include everybody. So I think there's this conceptual problem, who the people is, but also the fact that over time, those who have expanded the people are precisely those who were outside of it. So women who weren't fully enfranchised, fighting to be included, formerly enslaved people fighting to be recognized as full human beings. So democracy's motor, paradoxically, is like always from the outside, moving towards the inside. And part of why I wanted to make this film and write the book was to sort of implicitly just put that dynamic at the forefront, right? Democracy is not just this idea that these founding fathers had and, you know, we're like living out their perfect plan.
Has it ever been true? Is that arc of history, the people from the outside, expanding the populace, expanding the notion of the people, expanding the notion of what it is to rule, has it always moved in one direction?
No.
Because it doesn't feel like it's moving in that direction now.
No, I mean, it doesn't, right? I mean, it doesn't feel like it's moving that direction. And that's the thing. As I said in the scene you just saw, you know, progress can go into reverse. This is not some sort of linear thing where we're just moving towards a more perfect union and or we basically have it figured out and we need to like sort of tweak things on the margins. So I think that's what I wanted to get to with the title of the book. Democracy may not exist, but we'll miss it when it's gone. What I'm speaking to is my own ambivalence as a left-wing person, right? This is not democracy. We live in an oligarchy. We live in a world where political and economic power is held by a tiny number of people. And you know, lots of statistics back this up and lots of studies show that regular citizens have almost no say over policy, right? So we don't live in a democracy. At the same time, we don't want to be too glib and discount all the progress that's been made, the democratization that's happened. And so both projects try to live in that tension.
So as you come away from this, what is your sense of, like, where is the greatest urgency around actions? And then I want to get to this question of noun or verb, because that's another important thing.
Yeah.
Jean-Bertrand Aristide of Haiti always used to say elections aren't democracy. They're just the taking of the temperature of the democracy. How healthy is it?
Yeah, I like that. You know, we live in a very politicized moment. So I began this project, I wrote the proposal for the film. So in 2013, which seems like another era, right? So the book, you know, does not really focus on this current moment in a news-driven sort of way.
Right.
Neither does the film. It's saying the problems with our political system go back much further than November of 2016, right?
Right.
And let's take this longer view.
Although they do help us think about this moment.
Yes, but they try to help us think about this moment and sort of what have been some of the problems that got us into this mess.
Is it as simple as capitalism? I mean, you would think a system that puts the majority in rule over a minority would not have a society where a minority, a tiny one, have all the assets and the resources and all the control.
I mean, I 100% agree. So I think that is the underlying thread of both projects, is the role of capitalism and the fact, I think, you know, I say in the introduction, the challenge of our time actually is expanding democracy from the political sphere. Yeah. So this idea of enfranchising everyone to the economic sphere. The biggest threat of our age is capitalism, which concentrates wealth, concentrates power. That's antithetical to democracy. Post-1989, the idea was that capitalism and democracy are the same thing. This is the idea I grew up with, mm-hmm. right? That I was told. I didn't believe it, but you were told that if mm-hmm. you didn't believe it, you were silly. But now those are splitting apart. And so what I encountered while making the film was that there are actually a lot of young people who are coming down on the side of capitalism. That Trump supporters, the young Trump supporters I met, they don't actually dress themselves up in the rhetoric of the people. They talk about the fact that they want to achieve the American dream. Mm-hmm. One girl says in the film, I care more about the American dream and that ability to climb than democracy. Then we see another movement, which is the movement I'm very excited about, which says, well, hold on, we're on the side of democracy. And if we want democracy, if we want political equality, we need to have economic mm-hmm. equality, which means we need to jettison capitalism and create something, a new economic system, call it socialism, eco-socialism, democratic socialism, so that democracy can finally become more robust. So I think capitalism has to be right there at the center. I think if we ever transcend capitalism, we'll just get more interesting democratic questions, because finally we won't have to be debating this problem of, you know, should billionaires control the wealth in the world? But we'll get to think about how should we actually govern ourselves, which is really tricky.
When the Voting Rights Act was last reauthorized by Congress, it received 98 votes in the Senate. It was not a partisan issue. George W. Bush proudly signed it into law.
That was in 2006. But here's the thing. Michael says that period of 40 years or so after 1965 was really the only time in U.S. history when there seemed to be a consensus about universal voting rights.
It's become much more contentious, much more of a political fight in recent years. But I guess you could take some solace from the fact that when you look at the country's history, who gets to vote, how people vote, the effort to widen the franchise and the effort to stop that from happening has always been very political. It's been something that people have fought about and fought elections about. So it's not unusual, really, that people are fighting about how we vote and who votes right now. It's actually calm and placid uniformity in some ways is more unusual.
I mean, that's obviously true if you look at the history we covered this season. Even that temporary consensus was superficial. Remember in episode 8, we heard the conservative leader Paul Weyrich speaking in 1980 saying, I don't want everybody to vote. So there were always people seething about widespread voting rights and looking for ways to shut them down.
And those people won a huge victory in 2013 when the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in the Shelby County case. A key part of the Voting Rights Act required states with a history of racial discrimination in voting to get federal approval before they could change their laws in ways that might affect access to the vote. Chief Justice Roberts wrote the majority opinion, striking down that part of the law. He essentially said, the country has changed, the South has changed, black voters don't need this federal protection anymore.
And Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote a very ringing dissent, and it was kind of the dissent that made her the notorious RBG. Really, people took note of it. And she said, that's like standing in a rainstorm, holding an umbrella, and not getting wet, and concluding, therefore, that you don't need an umbrella and throwing away the umbrella because you're not wet. What happened? Well, literally within hours of the Supreme Court's ruling, states began to implement voting laws to make it harder for people to vote, especially harder for people of color to vote.
All across the South, states controlled by Republicans got to work changing their election laws. A favorite move was to require voter ID at the polls. It just happens that, guess what? About 10% of eligible voters don't have a driver's license. And those folks are disproportionately black, brown, and poor. So in Texas, the new law said, A gun registration card is an acceptable substitute for a driver's license, but a student ID is not. Students tend to vote for Democrats, and folks who own guns, well, yeah, you see how that goes.
Republican legislatures have shortened early voting periods, which are very popular with black voters. A lot of get-out-the-vote efforts by black churches, for example, Souls to the Polls, take advantage of early voting. These states reduced the period in which that can happen. They closed thousands of polling places in black and brown neighborhoods. Here in North Carolina, where I live, a court said the state's new election laws were written with almost surgical precision to target black voters.
The courts have struck down some of these laws up to now. But this is one reason it's so significant that President Trump and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, have pushed through 200 new right-wing judges since Trump took office.
Yes, that's after they stonewalled a whole bunch of President Obama's judicial appointments, not just Merrick Garland in the Supreme Court, but throughout the federal courts.
As the courts change and the federal courts become more and more conservative and arguably more and more partisan, you may start to see significantly different rulings from those courts. Throughout the country's history and increasingly now, we can't be certain that the courts are going to step in. These fights ultimately play out at the ballot box and in the court of public opinion.
So what it's going to take to protect and reinstate the Voting Rights Act is for Congress to act, to basically pass a new version of the law. But for that to happen, Americans will have to vote in a different kind of Congress, one where Republican supporters of voter suppression don't have the power to block a new Voting Rights Act. Another anti-democratic strategy that needs to be stopped is gerrymandering. Most of you all know this, but it's the practice of drawing legislative districts to advantage or disadvantage one political party, and it's often done using race. For example, corralling all the black voters in a given area into one district in order to keep those voters from having any impact in other districts.
Gerrymandering is as old as the country. The word should be pronounced gerrymander because it's named for Elbridge Gerry, one of the framers of the Constitution, whose name came up early in the season.
And by the way, he's the guy who said at the Constitutional Convention that America's problem was too much democracy.
Yes, that guy. The thing is, as far as gerrymandering, computer technology has made it so efficient and effective to the point where states like Wisconsin and North Carolina are just about hardwired to stay in Republican hands, even when a majority of votes statewide go to Democrats. In 2018, Democrats got slightly more votes overall in assembly races in Wisconsin, and Republicans still came out with a 27-seat majority. Meanwhile, in Maryland, a court found Democrats had gerrymandered the state to benefit themselves.
The reason this is a problem in the first place is that most states allow the majority party in the state legislature to control the drawing of districts. That's an invitation to the party in power to stay in power, never mind the will of the people. Here's Michael Waldman again.
In the last decade, it's been the Republicans who benefited from that because they won the midterm elections in 2010. But both parties have done this when they could. And the movement around the country to take on gerrymandering has actually been embraced by people of left and right and center. In 2018, for example, four states passed ballot initiatives, creating commissions or doing other reforms. You have redistricting reform or independent commissions drawing the district lines all over the country. Or there are states where there's redistricting reform done by courts and other things like that.
These efforts in different parts of the country may not be necessary if the Supreme Court had ruled that partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional, which they had a chance to do in 2019, but they refused to weigh in.
The Roberts Court will be known for its rulings on democracy and not in a good way. So again, it's going to be up to voters to make it clear they care about this.
Boss Tweed, the head of the Tammany Hall political party, used to say, "I don't care who does the electing as long as I get to do the nominating." So this conception, this kind of conception of politics has an obvious logic to it, right? Because if you control the nomination, every candidate is going to worry what you, the nominator, think. So you practically control the candidate, whether or not you control the ultimate election. We can call that genius theory for destroying democracy, Tweedism. tweedism. Any two-stage process where the tweeds get to nominate and then the rest get to select is tweedism, and the consequence of tweedism, obviously, is to produce a system responsive to tweeds only. Now, tweedism was practiced not just in the North, not just in New York, it was practiced in the South, too. Texas, 1923, practiced tweedism. By law, in 1923, Texas passed a statute that said, in the Democratic primary, only whites could vote. Only whites could vote. Blacks could vote in the general election if, of course, they could get registered, given all the barriers to registration. But only whites could vote in the Democratic primary. And, of course, back then, hard to imagine, but back then, the only party that mattered was the Democratic Party in Texas. So in this two-stage process, blacks were excluded from the first stage, 16% of Texas excluded from this critical first stage, with the consequence obviously producing a democracy responsive to whites only. Now, those cases are obvious to us. Everyone looks at that and says, there's something obviously wrong with those so-called democracies to set up their structure in that way. So why don't we see it here? We take it for granted in the United States that campaigns will be privately funded. But we need to recognize funding is its own contest. Funding is its own primary. We have the voting system where people vote, but in the first stage to that, there is a money primary that determines which candidates are allowed to run in those voting elections. Now, that money primary takes time. Members of Congress and candidates for Congress spend anywhere between 30 and 70% of their time dialing for dollars. This is an old telephone. You might not recognize this, but dialing for dollars, calling people all across the country to get the money they need to run their campaigns or to get their party back into power. B.F. Skinner gave us this wonderful image of the Skinner box where any stupid animal could learn which buttons it needed to push for its sustenance. This is a picture of the life of the modern American congressperson. As the modern American congressperson comes to learn which buttons he or she needs to push to get the sustenance he or she needs to make his or her campaign successful. This is their life, and it has an effect. Each of them, as they do this, develop a sixth sense, a constant awareness about how what they do might affect their ability to raise money. They become, in the words of the X-Files, shape-shifters, as they constantly adjust their views in light of what they know will help them to raise money, not in issues 1 to 10, but in issues 11 to 1,000. Leslie Byrne, a Democrat from Virginia, describes that when she went to Congress, she was told by a colleague, quote, always lean to the green. And to clarify, she went on, you know, he was not an environmentalist. So this obviously is a primary too. It's the money primary. It's not a white primary, it's the green primary. It's the first stage in a multi-stage process to select the candidates who will represent us. So if this is the structure, we should interrogate who are the funders. Well, we can think about who the biggest funders are. In 2014, the top 100 gave as much as the bottom 4.75 million funders to congressional campaigns. In this election cycle so far, 400 families have given half the money in the election contributions and contributions to super PACs so far. 400 families. That's not American democracy. That is banana republic democracy. And then we can think not just about the biggest funders, but think about the relevant funders. Of course, the people giving millions of dollars have the attention of the members of Congress. But how much do you need to give to be relevant? How much do you need to give to matter to those Congress people as they're dialing for dollars to raise money from you? Well, let's take the people who maxed out in 2014. And in 2014, that means you gave $5,200 to at least one candidate in the general primary and in the general election. 2014, it turns out 57,874 Americans maxed out in that way. So we could say 57,874 gave enough to matter, to control, to be the dominant force in this first stage of the election process. And then some of you out there, the math geniuses out there, beginning to do the numbers, you're thinking 57,874? Wait a minute. That's 0.02% of America. 0.02% of America dominate this first stage in the process of electing the candidates who will represent us. They pick the candidates, because you can't be credible unless you get their money, and we get to vote for those candidates. This tiny fraction of the 1%, this Chinese fraction of the 1%, dominate this first stage with the consequence, obviously, of producing a democracy responsive to these funders only.
Amid obvious attempts to suppress the vote and then the president's legal efforts to get the vote counters to quit while he was ahead in those states, and in Michigan, weirdly, where he wasn't, this week presents yet more evidence that the Conservative Party is not a political ideology enamored of free elections. A while back, Matthew Sittman, host of the Know Your Enemy podcast, explained to us how and why in recent years an expanding array of Republican politicians and thinkers have dropped the pretense of being concerned with democracy, and how it has become unafraid to impose the will of the minority onto the majority for what it deems the greater good. Rick Perlstein, historian of American conservatism and author most recently of Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980, has tracked this anti-majoritarian current in the American right back centuries. Sure, he says, conservatives are happy to win and keep power by means of a majority coalition, but Perlstein says they've long sought to win and hold power even in its absence. It's a tradition that began pretty much with the birth of the nation.
Well, of course, the invention of the Senate and the idea that slaves would be counted as 3/5 of a person were not majoritarian ideas, right? I mean, even then you had big states and small states.
But, he says, the modern minoritarian project of the American right really got going in the 1950s.
In the 1950s, the conservative coalition, which included both reactionary Southern Democrats and conservative Republicans in the North, were very dismayed to learn that the first Republican president since the New Deal, Dwight D. Eisenhower, bought into the New Deal. And then, of course, you get Brown versus the Board of Education. Guys who eventually became the people who ended up drafting Barry Goldwater as the Republican nominee for president, their first idea was to run a right-wing former IRS commissioner named T. Coleman Andrews, who not only was a segregationist, but believed that the federal income tax should be banned. And their idea was quite explicitly that if they can only get a few electoral votes, say from his own state of Virginia or from Mississippi or from Alabama or more of the above, and if they could deny the Democrats and the Republicans a majority in the Electoral College, they could basically throw the election into the House of Representatives, where there was, in fact, pretty much a liberal majority, but they could do so for concessions.
Was it successful?
Absolutely not, but they tried again. So going into 1960, they had the idea of putting up for president a Southern segregationist in the South as a Democratic candidate in primaries, Orville Faubus, and to get a conservative in the North. And then when they lost at their respective party conventions, they would choose one of them to run for president on this kind of united conservative Southern and Northern ticket. And again, the idea was only to deny a majority of electoral votes. And then they would, you know, negotiate for the kind of concessions they wanted, you know, to say, and Brown versus the Board of Education, completely indifferent to the fact that these were completely minority positions. Then they fell in love with this guy, Barry Goldwater, and they realized he had a lot of the same ideas, but they could draft him as a Republican for president in 1960. You know, he didn't go for it, but the Republican Party itself was very weak. It's basically gliding along on Dwight D. Eisenhower's charisma. All these kind of precinct organizations in every county in every state could be taken over. And the guy who actually authored this strategy was a Republican operative named F. Clifton White. And he literally described his method as having been borrowed by the Stalinists that he had seen in the 1930s and 1940s, who were able to take over liberal organizations by exploiting parliamentary procedure, keeping the meeting going until 2 a.m. and then call a vote when no one was there and they would have control. And they were able to get Barry Goldwater the nomination in 1964.
Just by exhausting the people who were there?
By exhausting this weak organization. They said it was so easy. It was like pushing on an open door. So here they were with this nominee that, according to one poll that came out during the Republican convention, on 7 out of 8 issues, the majority of Republicans disagreed with Barry Goldwater. So this was a minoritarian coalition even within the Republican Party. But one of the things that really took off during the 1964 election on an organizational level was the sort of panic over supposed Democratic voter fraud.
Generated by the minoritarian Republicans supporting Barry Goldwater?
Yes, they started something called Operation Eagle Eye. It came out of this folklore, the idea that the Democrats stole the election in 1960 supposedly by voting dead people in Chicago. Literally, they had a guide that explained that you should challenge anyone who doesn't look like a real voter. One of the people who was in charge of this very similar system of claiming Democratic voter fraud in order to intimidate voters so they don't go to the polls and can't cast their votes was a friend of Barry Goldwater's from Arizona named William Rehnquist, went on to an illustrious career.
As a chief justice appointed by Reagan.
Right. So both in his Senate hearings to become Supreme Court justice and then to be chief justice, it came up that he had intimidated voters in the polls in 1962 and 1964 by forcing Spanish-speaking people to read the Constitution, that there were people posted at voting places with very scary-looking uniforms. So again, this very continuous idea that if more people vote, Republicans are disadvantaged. One of the things that Jimmy Carter realized when he became president was that it was very hard to register to vote. A lot of people who wanted to vote had a hard time voting, you know, the same kind of stuff we see now. So one of the first major initiatives he undertook as president in the spring of 1977 was to come up with a comprehensive voting reform plan that he presented to Congress, proposing to have a constitutional amendment to end the Electoral College and to have same day registration. When he announced this, there was overwhelming support from both parties. The head of the Republican National Committee, a guy named William Brock, said that it was a quote unquote Republican idea. But lo and behold, the right wing of the party cried foul. The right wing magazine Human Events called it euthanasia for the GOP. Another figure enters the story, Reagan, the former governor of California, who's, you know, making a tidy living, writing newspaper columns and giving radio addresses every day. He calls this a horrifying prospect, and he revives that story of civil servants voting because their bosses tell them to, of dead people voting. One of Reagan's arguments was that Jimmy Carter won in Minnesota because of same-day registration, and that this proved that he wanted to, you know, use this kind of same-day registration scheme to assure Democrats won every election. And once again, the argument is Republicans are harmed when more people vote. You know, 1980, the Christian right held a massive rally for ministers in Dallas. One of the speakers said that, you know, the Republicans had to be the good government party. And then up stepped to the microphone, a Christian right pioneer, a new right organizer named Paul Weyrich, who gave a very famous speech.
They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
I think of Weyrich as one of the pioneers of direct mail campaigning.
Right. They would send out these thousands and thousands of letters, you know, accusing Democrats of wanting to have homosexuals teach their children or give welfare to college students. You know, much like today, elections that the polls thought were in the bag for the Democrats suddenly turned up roses for the Republicans, much like, you know, the kind of target advertising we see on Facebook. It was not, you know, the idea that two candidates fight it out on the terrain of ideas before the public. It was this underground media that was feeding horror stories about the Democrats. We saw that attitude carried into the Reagan administration itself, right? I mean, what was one of Ronald Reagan's dearest policy goals? Supporting the anti-communist insurgents in Nicaragua, known as the Contras. It was just, after Vietnam, an extraordinarily unpopular idea.
So he snuck around and did it without buy-in from the Congress.
Where democracy didn't work, subterfuge intervened. And that was the whole genesis of this conspiracy to illegally fund this very vicious right-wing army in Nicaragua.
By selling arms to Iran.
You know, if democracy doesn't work, other means just may be necessary.
I guess it was the active expression of an idea that was gaining steam at the time, the doctrine of the unitary executive.
After the Vietnam War and after Watergate and after a best-selling book called The Imperial Presidency by Arthur Schlesinger, there was an enormous popular mood to, you know, rein in the executive branch's power to act unilaterally. Among conservatives, most prominent among them, a young congressman named Dick Cheney, the idea was that, you know, the executive branch had to get its power back. This is also an inherently minoritarian project, of course, because the idea that once you elect a president, no rules should constrain his activity is much more of a monarchical ideology than a democratic one. This is all running in parallel with this project that begins with Ronald Reagan creating an ideologically supplicant judiciary. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that happened in 1981 when Ronald Reagan took over was that the appointment of judges was taken out of the hands of elected senators. It used to be under previous Republican presidents like Eisenhower and Nixon and Ford that basically when they needed a federal judge, they would go to a senator who would suggest someone almost on a patronage basis. Right. But what the Reagan administration did was they began scouring the law schools, scouring the federal judiciary for conservative clerks, and they set up this whole ideological evaluation bureaucracy with computers and everything, testing their ideological opinions on, you know, every issue under the sun. And this was extremely controversial at the time.
Litmus tests?
Exactly. Litmus tests. Right, but this is, once again, this minoritarian project where you can kind of lock in power, whatever the popular mood.
But is it exclusively conservative policies that are associated with this minoritarian project?
The fact of the matter is the kind of social policies or tax policies that Democrats favor are often popular. And that presents a profound dilemma for a political party in a democracy that wants to undo those policies. So, you know, when it comes to something like Social Security, the Cato Institute says, you know, this is their Leninist strategy. We must recognize that there is a firm coalition behind the present Social Security system. Basically, they're saying Social Security is popular. Before Social Security can be reformed, which means, you know, end, we must be able to divide this coalition and cast doubt on the picture of reality it presents to the general public. Casting doubt on the picture of reality doesn't sound like normal democratic politics to me, right? It sounds like conspiratorial politics because, you know, in a fair fight, in the battleground of ideas, they lose.
What about the nature of hierarchy and class and authority? Do those things find a place in that effort?
The bottom line of why conservative politics is conservative is it's about preserving the existing hierarchy. It's about preserving authority. It's, you know, about keeping society in its proper place, right? And the striking thing about that is there have been all kinds of policies that have been considered conservative over the years. In fact, you know, I used to have a Ku Klux Klan pamphlet from the 1920s that was calling for national health insurance program. Because immigrants are dirty and we don't want to get sick, right? You know, obviously, it's big intrusive government when you have government agents, you know, breaking into immigrants' homes and snatching them from their children, right? Small government, big government. Ultimately, what the name of the game is preserving hierarchy and authority. If it means, you know, more social programs, it's okay. If it means less social programs, it's okay. And if it means states' rights, it's okay. And if it means violating states' rights. I mean, the extraordinary things we've been seeing from the federal courts leading up to the 2020 presidential election of individual judges reaching deep into the guts of state voting rules. Nothing could be further from the Constitution's injunction that states run their own voting systems imaginable.
So how does understanding the history of the American right in this way change things?
It forces some very hard questions about our very conception of these two broad coalitions, factions, parties, whatever you want to call them, that make up the American political culture. You know, left and right, liberal, conservative, Democrat, and Republican. You know, we uphold this ideal of bipartisanship as a way to preserve and extend democracy. When do we begin to get to a point where we have to think of cooperating with a party which has turned minoritarian, anti-democratic ideals and rank distortion of reality into its program for keeping and holding power? When did they disqualify themselves from cooperation?
What's coming up next is one or more segments that were originally only for members, but since this is a reposted episode, I've unlocked them for everyone. Enjoy, and if you like getting the extra content, think about becoming a member yourself.
In Brett Kavanaugh's first decision as a Supreme Court justice, the Supreme Court just cut off voting rights for Native Americans in North Dakota by only allowing residents with street addresses to vote, knowing full well that the United States Postal Service only gives tribal residents P.O. boxes. This obvious attempt at voter suppression is nothing new for the United States, which the Economist Intelligence Unit has marked as not a full democracy 2 years in a row. First of all, just 2 years, all right? And one could probably say, we're not a democracy. We're a constitutional representative republic, a form of democracy. And you're saying that because you're boring. Because maybe it's not a good thing that after two out of the three recent presidents did not win the majority of the vote, and one of those just nominated a wildly unpopular judge to the Supreme Court, and that wildly unpopular judge was confirmed with little care or transparency by a majority party that did not get the majority vote due to decades of voter suppression and gerrymandering in order to curb democracy and gain power, after sitting on the previous wildly popular president's choice for more than a year, and then Mitch McConnell blames it on the Democrats getting rid of the filibuster court appointments, which they only did because Mitch McConnell said he would block every single judge indefinitely. But that's just how America works, you say, awfully. The Founding Fathers wanted to make sure the powerful few couldn't be overly influenced by the people. Good point. Maybe the best idea for a government ever wasn't thought of by a bunch of rich white slave owners in the 1700s. Hell, even Thomas Jefferson thought the Constitution should be rewritten every generation, by his estimation, every 19 or so years. But the Republicans like this, because they're actually anti-democracy. They only care about power. They don't want people to vote because they know the majority of the country disagrees with them on just so many of their proposed policies. They've made sure companies and the wealthy have a disproportionate amount of power and influence over politics. They do not care that that is not democracy. They try to dismiss any opposition, claiming all of these people are funded by George Soros. But maybe Republicans always talk about this George Soros conspiracy because they all get paid by billionaires to spout bullshit and influence politics. The Koch brothers literally bragged about it. Maybe they talk about paid protesters so much because they can't fathom anyone caring about something enough to protest if they're not getting paid. Maybe the president announced his own campaign by paying people to be in the crowd and didn't pay them for over a year until he got sued. Maybe Mike Pence went to a football game specifically to protest the players' protest, which cost taxpayers $325,000. America's official paid protester, Mike Pence. And speaking of paid protesters, when the president lost the popular vote, no, not that one. That one! When he lost the popular vote and there was a recount, the GOP paid a bunch of GOP operatives to pretend to be Florida citizens protesting the recount. It was called the Brooks Brothers Riot. Literally, paid protesters by the GOP to protest democracy. One of them was Roger Stone, Trump's buddy and best friend of and back tattoo haver of Richard Nixon, famous for inventing rat f***ing.
The idea that public schools should exist for a common good, that public schools are, as Horace Mann said, the great equalizer, but also understanding the reality does not match the lofty ideal, which is, you know, what happens when you are a country founded both on slavery and freedom at the same time.
Public education is the foundation of our democracy. This often repeated phrase messes with my head, not because it's inaccurate, but because it's true. Hillary Moss is professor of history and black studies at Amherst College and the author of the book Schooling Citizens. She says early public schools, or common schools as they were known, were formed during a period of great political anxiety.
Early 19th century, individuals are absolutely consumed and concerned about the fate of the republic. So the very idea that there is something that is a stable democracy or a stable American democracy that is something that will be perpetual and long-lasting, is not something that they take for granted.
The founders of common schools in the 1830s and 40s were explicit. Their job was to take a mishmash of working-class Catholic and Protestant children and turn them into Americans. Of course, who was allowed in and who wasn't mattered tremendously.
And if the central argument then is that these are citizen-making institutions, but the only individuals that are allowed in are white, the implication of that then is citizenship is something that is predicated on whiteness.
Native American children were forced away from their families into government boarding schools, where the explicit intention was to, quote, kill the Indian to save the man. Under slavery, African Americans were often prohibited from learning to read and write, and they were excluded from the common schools that first emerged in Boston, Baltimore, and other cities. Again, Nicole Hannah Jones.
And so, of course, scholars of the time, particularly scholars who were looking at the exclusion of black children, argue that that meant that black children were not supposed to be part of the body politic. They did not need to be educated for democracy because they were not to take part in democracy. And many people would argue that our schools are continuing to suffer from that legacy today.
So I want to know, how is JFK Middle School preparing you to be a citizen of the United States?
I don't know.
How is it preparing you for citizenship?
This might sound really dumb, but like suspensions, like that's like going to jail. Like, can't break the law if, when you're an adult. You go to jail, and that's part of being a citizen, so I guess in a way they kind of are.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you see patterns of what that looks like for, like, which are the kids that seem to get...
Wait, more? Pause. Do you want me to say black and Puerto Rican kids get suspended more? Like, maybe because it's the truth. So is that what you're looking for?
I'm not looking for that, but I'm interested in hearing what you see. So that's what you're seeing?
I mean, it's a fact.
Silas's observed reality is indeed a fact. Last year, according to state data, Latino kids were suspended almost three times as often as white kids at Silas's school. Silas, I should make clear, is white.
I think our public schools continue to reflect whom we believe to be full citizens and who we believe to be the people who should have the most say in our democracy and who we think are expendable and probably should not be making decisions. I think our schools reflect who we think are capable of self-governance and who we think need to be governed.
Start with school segregation. Silas's school is 18% Latino. A few miles down the interstate in Holyoke, Mass., the middle schools are 90% Latino. that district is currently operated under receivership, meaning local democratic control has been removed by the state due to chronic low student performance. This pattern of segregation leading to low performance is replicated in every state in the country. But as the stats make clear, it's not just about school segregation. Black and Latino kids in predominantly white districts are being underserved and over-disciplined as well. I've pulled out my computer. Silas and I are confirming the suspension stats for his school. But he's confused. Maybe because he lives day to day inside what Hannah Jones calls a fundamental paradox.
What is kids of color getting suspended more have to do with being prepared to be a citizen?
Really? You're asking that question?
I don't know. I just, like...
I'm going to turn the question that you asked back around on you. What does this have to do with citizenship?
I don't know. I think it shows people, like, who they can trust. Like, at this
Be more
point,
specific.
I think, like, if this many Puerto Rican kids are getting suspended, it makes people feel like the system's against them. And that, like, they're not meant to succeed. And it can just be kind of demoralizing.
So that's how the Latino kids, the Puerto Rican kids, might experience it stepping into this school system that operates in this way. What messages do you think white kids in this kind of school system get about being a citizen in our society?
Like that they don't need to do much. That, like, if you stay under the radar, then you'll be fine. Like, you don't need to be a good citizen. You can just stay out of trouble. And I mean, because there's plenty of white kids that, like, are just assholes, but they're under the radar assholes.
It's not hard to rail against an education system structured around segregation and other systemic inequities. The challenge is that there is no other institution that continues to bring Americans together across so many divisions as our public schools, which is why a curriculum like Action Civics can be a game changer. It builds the democratic dispositions of its student participants, even as those students work to fix the very problems that magnify inequity in their schools and communities.
People might assume that the United States has been democratic from the beginning. And, you know, with my students, we study the Constitution, and there are certainly ways in which the United States scaled up the whole notion of democracy for the world and introduced the ideas of representative government on a large scale and freedom of religion and so on. But of course, there were ways in which the founding was really undemocratic, anti-democratic, with slavery being incorporated into the Constitution, being the most obvious of those. And so in the United States, it's fair to say that democracy has developed over time. And I would say that it was really the 1960s that we became a fully democratic nation where civil liberties, civil rights, and voting rights were extended to all Americans, regardless of race and gender and so on. And so that was a long story about this arc of democratization. But what we're looking at in the book is periods of time where people were worried that whatever level of democracy had developed up till that point in time was under threat of deteriorating, of backsliding, that we could go back in the other direction of having less democracy. And it's really striking to me the number of times this has happened in the United States and when people had real anxiety that there was going to be backsliding. So that's our concern. And, you know, we were motivated to write the book by asking, is the United States in danger today of democratic deterioration? And the idea is not that there'll be tanks in the streets and, you know, a military coup d'etat. Scholars who study democratic deterioration find that while that kind of thing was common up through the middle of the 20th century, what's been more typical since then is backsliding, where you get some features of democracy that stay in place, like you might still have elections, and yet other aspects like the rule of law and the integrity of rights might be undermined, might become weaker.
This may be a sort of a little bit off topic, but tangentially speaking, I mean, where does economic rights fall in that spectrum? Because you mentioned that, you know, in the 60s, we had sort of reached a peak theoretically in terms of democracy within this continuum. But does that include some form of economic rights? I mean, have we become less democratic in the context of economics? And by less, I mean, are we backsliding? Like, for instance, when you disempower unions, I mean, like, definitionally, it seems to me that you have less union concentration. That is definitionally, it seems to me, less democratic, correct? And because the economy, obviously, and economic rights must be a factor within sort of assessing where we are on the continuum of democracy.
Yeah. Well, I agree that in a full and robust definition of democracy, it would include social rights and economic rights. In this book, we take more of a narrow, more strict definition of rights as being civil liberties, civil rights, and voting rights. But the kinds of dynamics you're mentioning are really important as a threat to democracy because, you know, this feature of rising economic inequality. Now, when I first heard that that can be a threat to democracy, I thought that must mean, well, the 99% rises up and you have instability. But that's not, in fact, what it means. It's actually the opposite. Scholars find that around the world and through history, when there's high and rising economic inequality, it's the most affluent, the rich and powerful industries, businesses, that then they decide to try to cement their power, to lock down what they have. And they don't care if they trample democracy in the process. And so I think, you know, we've been seeing that going on already over the last couple of decades as economic elites with their political accomplices have scaled back the power of organized labor, as you've mentioned, of workers generally. And, you know, we're in a really bad time these days for working Americans because of their rights being scaled back. And I think that's why that's come about.
Thanks for listening to another throwback episode plucked from the archives to give you context for today. We also produce funny and informative bonus episodes featuring conversations between the Best of Left producers, as thanks to those who support the show by becoming a member or purchasing gift memberships to the show. If you get value out of the show, we'd appreciate your support at bestofleft.com/support through our Patreon page or from right inside the Apple Podcast app. As always, you can keep the comments coming in by leaving us a voicemail or sending a text to 202-999-3991 or by emailing me to j@bestofleft.com. You can also continue the discussion by joining our Discord community, and there's a link to join that in the show notes. So, coming to you from far outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, coming to you twice weekly, thanks entirely to the members and donors to the show, from bestoftheleft.com.